I've always wanted to do that. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find out more about our organization and events online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. And tonight's event is Sadhguru and Paul Hawken Talk Socially Conscious Business. My name is Deb Nelson. I'm the Executive Director of Social Venture Network, and I'll be your host for this evening. So the concept of socially conscious business has been around for a long time, and it's evolving every day. And all around this country and around the world, more and more leaders are using and finding new ways to leverage the power of business to solve social and economic problems. And they're doing it by focusing on a triple bottom line, one that focuses on people, planet, and profit. And tonight we'll find out more about a conscious business paradigm and learn about the qualities of a leader in this new era, how entrepreneurs can create new values-driven businesses, and how established businesses can evolve into more conscious, values-driven organizations. And with us tonight, we have two visionary leaders, Sadhguru, who is a yogi, mystic, humanitarian, and founder of Isha Foundation. Sadhguru was named one of India's 50 most powerful people by India Today magazine and has spoken all over the world, including at the UN Millennium World Peace Summit and the World Economic Forum. And Paul Hawken is a well-known environmentalist, entrepreneur, and author. His work includes starting ecological businesses, writing about the impact of commerce on living systems, and consulting with heads of state and CEOs. He has also written many national bestsellers, including Ecology of Commerce and Blessed Unrest. And although they come from two very different backgrounds, they are both very effective leaders who are working at the intersection of business and spirituality. And so we brought them together to explore what business with a higher purpose looks like. So I'll start with the first question, and then I'm going to step away for half an hour, and we'll come back and take questions from the audience. So, Paul, I'd like to kick it off with a question to you, and that is, what does socially conscious business really mean?
thank you, Deb. I'll tell an SVN story. I think it goes back 20 years. And this is on Social Venture Network, just started, and I think it was in New Jersey. And SVN had brought Anita Roddick from the Body Shop to SVN, or she came anyway. And I was sitting next to Mel Ziegler, who is the founder of Banana Republic, and Bruce Cates, the founder of Rockport. And we're all watching this presentation from Anita Roddick. And it was just mind-numbing, blowing. It was just like, whoa, and it was high def and this and movies and, you know, trucks with six-foot pictures of Stephen Biko, you know, and Nelson Mandela and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and, you know, her in the Amazon jungle with paint on her face getting sourcing ingredients and statements that women are being objectified and they should never think that they're not beautiful. It was just a stunning presentation. And it was over, and I turned to Mel and Bruce, and I said, what do you think? And Bruce said, I think I've wasted my whole effing life. It was so overwhelming. But I think we have to understand that the idea of socially conscious business goes back 400, 500 years. It's not new at all. It's not just this last 40, 50 years. I mean, Quaker Oats, Heinz Company, you know, so many companies in the United States, A&P, you know, that's gone now, but it started with a very clear social mission. And I think what's changed now, of course, is the internet and what does social mean? Because social used to mean social, like your society, the people around you. And now it's come to mean something very different on the social side. And unconscious, I think I agree with Sadhguru that conscious is a loaded term. I think intelligence or awareness is the term, or really it's connected. And to me, a socially conscious business is highly connected to its place and to its people and to its culture. And I think we've come to think that the sort of Promethean businesses, you know, like Google and others, you know, that are world famous and whose, you know, founders are very rich, are socially conscious. And to me, socially conscious businesses are like Acme Bread, you know, in Berkeley. And And it's the midwives and the craftspeople and the farmers and the artisan food makers and those we don't hear about, but we actually do business with. And they're the ones who are never going to sell out and basically manage their portfolio in Kauai. They're the ones who are going to be with you for their whole life and be involved with the community. So to me, socially conscious is really an old-fashioned virtue. It's not triple bottom line, in which, you know, John Elkington coined that term, which is great. But it's not even that division and that sense of like there's this and there's that and there's that and somehow, you know, they've got to drive each other. It is so coherent and integrated that the person doesn't really have to think about it. Big corporations have to figure out the triple bottom line. What do you think?
if whatever the business, if it's not useful to the people, why are they in business and how are they in business? That's something we have to look at. So what I would say is just about everything that is successful is useful in some way. It is a tragedy that people who are doing it may not be conscious that they're useful. They may be just thinking of profit, profit, profit as the bottom line, but they don't understand or enjoy that they're creating something worthwhile for the world, which they're anyway doing. Actually, you know, I must say this. The first time when I was at the Economic Forum in Davos, people were almost resentful. Why is a mystic attending a business meeting? I happened to be at a dinner table with someone who was a leading computer makers of the time, and he asked this question, why are you here? So I asked him, see, what's your business? He said, we are one of the largest computer makers in the world. They got bought over by the Chinese some time ago. So I said, see, whether you manufacture a computer or a safety pin, the essential business is human well-being. It's just that you've forgotten. That's the only problem with you. Whether you make safety pin or spacecraft, it's still useful to the people. That's the reason why it's in business. But you have forgotten, and because of that you suffer. If you were conscious of this, you would enjoy the process of doing it and maybe you would do better things than simply doing something that after 25 years you will regret or the world will regret that we did this. So business survives and thrives only because it's useful to people. So I don't believe that you have to be socially conscious on top of it. You are. If you're not conscious, you won't survive. That's how I see it. It's just that they may not be enjoying that. They may not be enjoying that they are making a contribution to everybody's life on a daily life. I think they becoming conscious of that is important so that doing business doesn't break people in the end. That success is right now breaking up people. I see successful people carrying a lot more miserable faces than not so successful people. You will see not so successful people walking the beach and they're much happier. The very successful people are carrying stiff, rigid, long faces, and that's a wrong message because success is the sweetest thing on the planet. In human life, success is important. Right now, successful people are sending out a message that success is suffering, and that's bad. When that happens, the younger people will think, what is the point pursuing this? Smoking pot on the street side is better than being successful, at least we are happy. This philosophy will evolve once we have suffered this 40 years ago. We will again come to this if we do not send out the message that success is sweet and wonderful. And that will happen if they become conscious of the contributions that they're making.
Do you think, I mean, for me, success though, how it's defined, you're defining it as being happy and that it's being, enjoying it, that it's having pleasure from doing what you do initially, not because of the actual outcome. But it seems to me, and I agree with you about the long faces, that's for sure, but also it seems to me that we're in a world where business has gone right off around the bend. Business is basically destroying its host and rationalizing it and, you know, calling it lots of things and justifying it and, you know, maybe, you know, paying great returns to their shareholders or the investors. But in fact, most commerce today is destroying the earth. and not by intention necessarily, but by fact. And it seems to me when we're talking about social conscious business, we're talking to a new generation of people, especially around here, but everywhere, who in fact see that. And then I know for myself, when I went into business, actually everyone disapproved. All my peers disapproved. I grew up in Berkeley, the only one of two communist towns in the United States at that time. You know. And when I went into business, it was as if I had, you know, joined the Nazi party. I mean, it was so disapproved, and I lost a lot of friends because they said, well, you know, that's the enemy. And when I wrote Ecology of Commerce, the same thing happened. My environmentalist friends said, how could you put those two words together, you know? So I think what we now have is a generation that doesn't make that distinction, doesn't make that separation. And for them, what they have to deal with is a, you know, investment community. We talked about venture capitalists. A community of, or a ethos, if you will, in commerce that is about speed, it's about growth, it's about, you know, it's not about the very things that you're talking about. And it seems to me that we're trying to restore, and I think what is happening is people are trying to bring back this thing, the social, the societal, the local, that is to bring business in back to us, which is not out there and not on the stock exchange and not something we read about, but something we interact with, something that actually does not only make us happy as the business people or the entrepreneurs, but actually makes other people happy. And I think that's hard to do right now because of the pressures.
See, $1 that's floating around, there are too many people trying to eat from that $1 that's floating around, okay? So when you say venture capitalists, there are so many people who are trying to draw sustenance from the same dollar which is making the rounds. So when there is investment like this, being socially conscious, doing something which is not all about profit is difficult. People may talk about it, but when it actually comes to action, it'll become very difficult because the pressures of generating something for that many people who are eating out of that dollar becomes a certain process.
Absolutely.
And about you losing your friends.
I made new ones, don't worry.
Because when you talk about an idea, which is a fantastic idea, but they may lose their money, you will lose friends. It may be a great idea long term, but today they're going to lose their dollar, you will lose friends. And for this to happen successfully, all these long-term ideas, it needs a certain level of administrative or governmental support. It cannot be done by active money which has to earn today to pay somebody tomorrow. That money cannot do this work. Mm. Right now, all this is being trying to be done by private investors, and private investment is on a fast track. It has to generate money. You can't keep it 10 years investment or 15 years investment of a payback schedule. It has to pay back in the 3 months or 6 months or 1 year. This is not just the investor's hurry, because the money comes from elsewhere. Who is in a hurry? And there are too many people on the way who are in a rush. So if these long-term ideas, which are truly wonderful for the world, have to happen, the government needs to invest in that. Otherwise, it's never going to happen. It's only going to be a talk, because private money cannot do that long-term. Private money will not go, you know, it can't span itself that distance.
We have some wonderful institutions here, the Rudolf Steiner Foundation, RSF, and then Woody Tash, Slow Money. We have actually now people and organizations really coalescing around this idea of the speed of money, that is, slowing it down and extending the timelines in which money is supposed to have a return on capital. EcoTrust in Portland is doing forest trusts, essentially, that pay a modest, you know, return, but they actually restore forest land. And now they're wanting to do that with farmland, that is to say, buy farmland that's been really mistreated and then buy it, restore it to organic, restore its biological qualities, and then I don't know how that's going to work with farmers, but nevertheless, this is a movement that's very strongly emerging, And I think people really understand that money needs to slow down. I was at a wonderful conference three weeks ago. I don't know if Lisa Gansky is here, but she put it on called Mesh. And it was about the sharing economy and the peer-to-peer and sharing. It was a fantastic conference, and one of the data points that really struck me was the one between Airbnb and Intercontinental Hotels. Intercontinental Hotels today is the largest hotel chain in the world. It has 650,000 beds, and Airbnb has 650,000 beds too, and they did it in 4 years, and with no capital for beds anyway. And but there's a paradox there, which is these new companies that are rising here, these sharing-based or peer-to-peer-based companies, are being funded by venture capital. So there's still that tacit understanding that somehow there's going to be this 40% return year on year on the capital paid in. And what I see, and I people show me their business plans and their spreadsheets, and they're really tortured in a sense to get them into shape to show this, you know, kind of growth. And that growth we understand biologically as cancer and not development. And so in a sense we're funding, as you say, because of proxy money. And proxy money doesn't have an owner. It's what I'm saying about local again. It doesn't. Who owns that money? You know, who that money for the VC might have come from a university. Well, where did that money come from? That came from alumni donors. And so the incentives that VCs have is really perverse, because it is about, you know, turning that money over quickly in order for them to be personally compensated and benefit. And so we look at the successes of VC money in the Googles and the Facebooks, et cetera, and we overlook, in fact, that is not a way, I don't think it's a way to fund the future. I think it's a way to destroy the future.
If the speed of the money has to slow down, in many ways, our lifestyles have to change. The pressure of lifestyle is transmitting or transforming itself into demand on the speed of money. Just slowing down the speed of money, and if our lifestyles are at a certain pace, and naturally the pressures build up. So this is something that we have to bring into the society and the consciousness of the people, that there is a better way to live without necessarily escalating our lifestyle. If this has to happen right now, we are in pursuit of happiness. It is also written into the Constitution that you have a right to pursue your happiness. It needs to be understood that all human experience is generated from within, whether it's misery or happiness or joy or whatever else. Everything is generated from within. We are not at all investing in that dimension. If you sit here and you are happy by your own nature, suddenly you will notice that your activity is no more compulsive. There is no such thing as you have to do this or you have to do that. You will do whatever is appropriate to the situations in which we exist. Right now people are in pursuit of happiness, and there is a certain compulsive activity. To fuel that compulsive activity, the money has to flow at a certain speed, and that speed is unrealistic. And something needs to be done about that, because we are always trying to transform situations in which we exist, not understanding situations are just a consequence of the kind of people that we are. We are never trying to transform the individual people. We are always trying to transform the situation. No, don't bother about the situation. Situation is just a product of the type of people that we are. If you transform the individual person, then the situation will naturally transform. But with the situation, you can just make a slogan and, you know, network on the Facebook and forget about it. Individual transformation means it has to begin with you, and you have to work with people. It's a long haul.
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing, though, is this, and if you look at the past 40 years, right now this fantastic evolution in terms of people's awareness of what does comprise, I think it's an awkward term, socially conscious business, but I'll use it. And one of those aspects is localization, and localization on every aspect. I mean, not just food networks and locavores, but actually, you know, money has to be localized. Because everything in business is really about relationships, again, social relationships. So, and the relationships have to be enduring and not based on money themselves. If it's based on money, it's not really a relationship, it's a transaction. And so money has to be localized. But it's not just money, energy has to be localized. We can't buy our solar panels from China. I'm sorry, it won't work. We buy oil from Saudi Arabia and our solar from China. What's changed? Nothing. And what I feel is happening, and certainly the Bay Area is a hotbed of that, is this sense of transforming the cities, transforming neighborhoods, transforming the relationships people have, not in a sense looking for scale and rapid growth as a means to measure success, but looking at small artisanal food producers and restaurants, and now the maker revolution in San Francisco, where people are coming back to the city to actually make things that were made overseas, in fact. So you're seeing this really rapid prototypical change occurring in cities all over the world, and especially here and along the coast. And I think it's really the harbinger of sort of a new city-state mentality, where the hub isn't going to be New York and London and money center banks, but the hub is going to be the culture of cities that have this increasing vibrancy. Some of San Francisco's vibrancy is paid for because there's so much money here. But, I mean, and there is. This is the richest place in the world now, from here south to San Jose. You are living in the richest place in the world. The only place that's richer is Mayfair, but that's because the Russian oligarchs and people live there, but it's not really that. This is it. You're in it. And so despite that, what I feel is a kind of authenticity growing up and developing and evolving, and I see it through SVN and so many other organizations, of people realizing that they have to, in a sense, and I use a quote from my colleague Amanda Ravenhill, but people have to hold hands and collaborate. And it's different than being the entrepreneurial hero, you know, the Promethean, over the top, I'm going to make it. And that's what I see starting to emerge. And I think that's a very, very happy, helpful, joyous even sign that people understand that, and that it's not dropping out, it's dropping in to what is humane. And as I've said, we need more humane beings. You know, we have too many maybe people on the planet, but we need more humane beings, and you become humane by the way you connect to each other. And so in the end, to me, it's about falling in love. And so what is socially conscious? It's falling in love. Falling in love with your family, your friends, your community, with the place you are, with all the critters and creatures that live there, and so forth. And once you're in love, what are you going to do? You're going to protect, you're going to nurture, you're going to, you know, and you're not going to go off on a bender and try to make, you know, $1 billion.
Yeah, that's a very popular answer that I'm going to disagree with. Definitely, you must fall in love, no question about it, because this is not for economic reasons. It's for the sweetness of your own life. You must fall in love. But with the Facebook and other things, why can't you fall in love with somebody in China or in Timbuktu? Why it has to be local? I feel localization of money would create a small oasis here and there. It'll never bring well-being to the larger world. If human beings have to get localized, right now I drove from San Jose and I started 2 hours early just to make sure that I'm here on time. And what I see is thousands of cars are moving this way and thousands of cars are moving that way. So people who are here are working there, people who are there are working here. And all we are thinking of is, I was driving in a Tesla, okay? All we are thinking of is producing a car which consumes less energy. We are never thinking of, why is it people who are here are working there, people who are there are working here? Why are they going in opposite directions every day? And either they can move to the right place and create those kind of cities where people can walk to their work or cycle to their work, or people can work there from their home. There's enough technology today that it is not necessary for everybody to go to work. Different kinds of modules can be created where you want to go somewhere, please go, drive. But you want to go to your work, which is an everyday thing. It is not necessary to be traveling 2 hours to work and 2 hours back. And you will see people are driving in opposite directions. They're not going, if The whole traffic in the morning is going one way and in the evening another way. Understandable. That's bad, but understandable. Now, half the population is going this way, other half of the population is going that way. It doesn't make any sense to me. Localization localization should be of the people. Money, you must internationalize. If you ask me at some point, we must aim at a common currency for the whole world. Right now, because of the economic disparities, it may not be possible. At some point, there must be an international currency which just sells everywhere. And localizing currency, localizing money transactions, a very romantic idea. It's very nice. You know, like there was an organization called Be the Change and they invited me to speak in this place in London and some 3,000 people from across the planet. And they were talking about how they want to take the world back to barter system, that all this currency, this financial markets, it's all fake. It is fake, no question about that. But it is serving a purpose right now. The problem right now is, before money becomes a productive process, in the pre-productive process itself, people are milking it hard, you know, right there.
Yeah, I think what I'm talking about localization is the banking system itself. And right now, I got an offer from Bank of America to change my mortgage, and because it's at 4.5% and you can get mortgages for 3.375, and I thought, well, I'll just call them up first. I have a friend who's a mortgage broker, but I called the bank. And I got in this voicemail hell forever, and this, and this, and this, and I was talking to somebody in India. So when I'm talking about, and hello, yes, can I help you? And so, and then what's your name? And then what's your social again? And over and over and over again. And then, well, what rate would you like? And I said, I asked you, I'm calling to see what you're offering, not what rate I would like. I'm not bargaining. To me, this is the idiocy of the system we have today. I'm sorry. And that is, when you have a local bank, it doesn't mean it's local currency. It means that the currency, it's our currency. We're lending to each other. There's trust. And the basis of a healthy economic system is trust. And there is no trust in the system. And the trust is gone. And we are being algorithmed and objectified by our banks, by our search engines, by our social media. And we're being studied and computed and recomputed and marketed to. We've all become objects to these huge institutions. And as Jaron Lanier talks about, the people with the biggest server farms and computers are winning, and they're concentrating capital. So when I'm talking about localizing, I'm not talking about barter systems. I'm not talking about let systems are fine, local exchange systems are fine too. What I'm talking about is relationships. Relationships, it means something. So when you call somebody, they say, oh, hi, how are you doing? And what do you need? Oh, let me get back to you, or whatever. I'm talking about a world that makes sense to us. And I'm just saying, as it's scaling, the financial system is making us, you know, sort of into, again, it's objectifying us, and it's making us into aliens, all of us, to a system that doesn't serve us. It's serving them, not us. And I think Lanier is very, very, very clear about this. When the 1% has more money than the middle class, democracy is dead. Because it's the middle class that is the fundamental core of democracy. And when the 1% has all the resources or most of the resources, you can kiss goodbye to politics, to policy, to decency, to regulations and governments making investments in those things that count. Because the investment is going to go to concentrated capital.
See, when we coined the word capitalism, that word came in because the access to capital was limited to a very small number of people. What you're saying is very true, that 1% has more money than what the rest of the whole population has. That's a fact. But what we also need to acknowledge is wealth is more distributed today than ever before in the history of humanity. That's a fact too. So we're in a process, and about Beijing or Bangalore being local is happening. It's not yet happened. Right now, talking to somebody in Bangalore, you're feeling like, oh, somebody who doesn't know me is talking. But that will change too. You will feel Bangalore is a local place after some time. It is still new. it is a still new happening. There are people who are falling in love halfway across the world right now because of their Facebook or whatever, okay?
He was embarrassed to tell me what time it was. It was 4 a.m.
Nothing wrong with 4 a.m.
Not if you're meditating, but if you're talking about mortgages.
What I'm saying is we have been used to certain things, but those things will change. As technology grows, I think a point will come, we don't know how far it is, a point will come where national boundaries won't mean anything. Because we are able to freely… If one person was not there, if Osama bin Laden was not there on this planet, if he did not exist, by now I think lot more transparency would have happened with technology. Right now we are using technology to wall us out, wall ourselves out. But we would have used technology to bring down all the walls if that one incident has not happened 10 years ago. That's how I see it. If the thing has not happened, we would have used technology to make the national borders porous. Right now we are using technology to make it impregnable. I think that is a one-time incident that need not repeat itself. We will get over that after some time. Right now everything is kind of framed around that one incident. I think at some point we have to get over that.
Yeah, I don't think anybody here, especially this room and the city, is arguing against internationalization or the fluidity with which we can have friends all over the world. And I do, and because of social media, and it's fantastic, no question about it. But I still think that when we're talking about economics, we're talking about socially conscious business. And we have to think of it, I think, in biological metaphors. And when you have a healthy watershed, it absorbs water very quickly and then releases it slowly. And it releases it slowly into streams and rivulets and finally rivers. And water is life, and there's no water, there's no life virtually. So when you're talking about an economic watershed, it also absorbs money quickly and releases it slowly into its, you know, canyons and into its riparian corridors of people and neighborhoods. And right now, what you have is the opposite situation being created. If you shop at a big box retailer, that money is in London that night. It's gone. It's not in this community at all. And only a very small amount of that money comes back. And so what I think we're seeing with what's being created and is really quite astonishing given the inertia and the momentum of the existing system that is, you know, almost overwhelming, is people trying to reconstruct what it means to have a humane and healthy society. And that involves transactions that are meaningful every step of the way. And it does not mean that money, when you spend it, is in London in somebody else's hands. I agree that it'd be really wonderful to have a common currency, no question about that, because it's politicized and used and there's currency wars and people pay the price for that, and that is unfair to them. But that commonality of currency doesn't mean there can't also be on the other side a real rich economy at home. And that depends on people and on relationships, on institutions that are rooted in their communities and not rooted in money center banks in New York that don't give a fig about our lives or who we are or what happens to us.
So when we started creating this World Trade Organization and things like that, the idea was to make the whole world into one single marketplace, not have different levels of markets. We have invested too much in that direction. But to get there, the journey is long. To get there, there are a few unpleasant steps that we have to take. When unpleasant steps need to be taken, when I say unpleasant, uncomfortable steps for ourselves, when we have to take it, if we turn around because it's uncomfortable, then the price will be even bigger. And the question of local markets existing by themselves, they'll invariably happen for certain products. But the larger financial market, if it is not leveled out, the disparities will continue, distrust will continue. Right now the way the nations are operating is never with each other, always against each other, one against the other. When big forces continue to operate one against the other, the expense of it is too much. The expense of two or five different groups working against each other in the world is so high the economic benefit will not reach the people. It is all spent in confronting each other at many different levels. This is a very complex confrontation. And you know, the deputy vice chairperson of the Bank of China, I was having a conversation with him. When we went into the mechanics of it, it all comes down to enormous distrust from one nation to another. If that one thing is brought down, if more sensible leadership, leadership which reaches out, leadership which will not think there's a big difference between this and that, somewhere we have to meet and operate. The only reason is because there is economic disparity. If you try to level it, people who are up there have to come down, that is not possible. You have to bring up the other people to some reasonable level before we talk about leveling it. I think we are on the process. It is just that what type of people are handling these situations is the only question for me.
I agree.
If you transform the people, the system can work even now.
Well, one of the wonderful things I heard on the MESH conference is a new company called Ripple, and Ripple is, I think it's going to bypass the money center bank. I think the people I trust are the ones who are going to bypass the government and the money center banks and the seats of power. And that's what's so beautiful about the internet, about social media, about Facebook, about what's going on, is that I think we can create a currency, a common currency, and bypass the whole nine yards. And I'm really looking forward to that. And if people within that want to create a local currency, they can do that as well. So it's not either or. But for sure, I don't really want to wait until they figure it out in the banks, in Switzerland, in Germany, in London, in New York, in Tokyo, in Hong Kong. What I love about what's going on right now in business is that people can bypass, in a sense, the traditional institutions that have basically the benefit from distrust almost, you know, and use it to their aims and use it to their ends and so forth. Deborah, you're going to come back and open this up to the audience? Yes, yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Sadhguru and Paul. Weren't they wonderful? As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. For more information about Inforum and its upcoming events, please visit facebook.com/InforumSF or follow us on Twitter at InforumSF. Tonight we're hosting Sadhguru and Paul Hawken as they talk about socially conscious business. Sadhguru is a yogi and mystic and founder of Isha Foundation. For more information, please visit sadhguru.org. Paul Hawken is an environmentalist, entrepreneur, and author. You can find out more about Paul at paulhawken.com. And I'm Deb Nelson, Executive Director of Social Venture Network. We're at svn.org. So we're going to start our question and answer period in a couple of minutes, and I'll invite you all to line up behind the mic. Don't hurt each other as you're lining up. I'm going to ask you to please ask single questions, no multiple part questions, no pitches, no stories. If you give us a multiple part question or make a pitch, I'm going to have to throw this gavel at you. Those are the words, so don't make me do it. So here's a transition question as you all are lining up at the mic. Most people don't find their jobs fulfilling or meaningful. So what would you say to the person who can't quite align their values with their work and they're not running the company or organization that they're working for, and turning a company into a values-driven organization doesn't happen overnight? What advice would you have for that person?
Well, the thing we'll notice is that the companies that really do make a difference, it's because the CEO really got it, and she or he really understands, and that's when you see change. It doesn't mean that the work that people are done when they're not aligned with the CEO, or the CEO is too busy or doesn't have the literacy required, can't make a difference. They do. My suggestion to them is really to approach it like they're learning. It's a very rich learning experience. In fact, there couldn't be a richer one than going into a dysfunctional company. I mean, and I'm serious. You learn so much, and really, it's very valuable because you won't stay there that long, and you'll be able to apply extraordinary amounts of insight that you wouldn't get from working at Patagonia, you know, which is really a functional company, in my opinion. And so, but I remember once dealing with a big multinational chemical company that does GMOs, and I won't name who they are. And We did, our colleague and I set up a thing where we got all the scientists together to create this spaceship, and there was a competition between all the chemical engineers, and they had to create a spaceship that would leave and come back in 100 years. And it could be as big as they wanted, and it could receive light, but you couldn't throw anything away. And then they loved it, they're engineers, and they're competing, and then at the end they all voted on which spaceship they'd go on. And even though they were competing, they all voted for basically the one spaceship. And that spaceship didn't take videos and DVDs, it took artists and musicians and storytellers. It didn't take any products from that company, not one single product, pesticides, chemicals was taken, because he said that would poison the environment. All the food was organically grown. They took weeds, which is their biggest selling product, to kill weeds. They took weeds because weeds help the subsoil and bring up minerals and make the soil healthy. And this is what everybody wanted to go on. And after that exercise, a whole bunch of them quit. So I think it's...
Touché.
So I think if you're not happy, it's a fantastic thing. It means there's some deep impulse in you that's leading you to something that's going to be really helpful to the world.
Sadhguru?
So when it comes to individual fulfillment, as I said earlier, instead of being in pursuit of happiness, if your life has become an expression of your joy, you'll always find a way to do something meaningful, wherever you may be, whatever your position may be. You may not be able to change the ways of a large corporation by yourself, but the little ecosystem around you, you can definitely change. But first thing, this must happen. You must understand this. The moment you're in pursuit of happiness, unknowingly you're working against so many things, so many things. Our pursuit of happiness has brought incalculable kind of misery to every other creature on this planet, but we are pursuing it sturdily and not getting there. We have pursued it very strong, using all the technology that we can put together in the last 100 years, but we are not any happier than people who lived here 100 years ago. So when we are not successful for 100 years, I believe it's time to stop and look back and see, why the hell are we going around without being successful about our goals? Because what needs to be done internally, we are trying to fix it externally. It's not going to work like that. Nobody is going to be fulfilled or happy because of things that are happening around them. That is only short term. You bring yourself to a certain level of joyfulness and fulfillment within you, then your activity is no more compulsive. Once it's not compulsive, you will do what's needed according to your intelligence and capability. Somebody else cannot fix this for you, because each person will act according to his own capacity to do things.
Thank you. And now we're ready to open it up to questions from the audience, and remember, single part questions. First question.
It is so single part, you'll be amazed. Sadhguru, question for you. You said we can't transform systems, we can't transform structures, we can transform people, because systems and structures are a natural occurrence, they're the reflection of who we are. How do you see the most effective way of accelerating that process of transformation?
To correct the question a bit, I did not say you cannot transform the system. You can transform the system much more easily than transforming people, but it is not the answer. You transform the system and populate the system with the same people, you will see it's the same thing again. You'll just... for a few days you think things have changed, after some time it's again the same thing because it's the same people. Transforming the people is a much longer haul. It is not one day slogan shouting, it's not one day's policy thing, it is something that we have to work with our children on the street, in the office, everywhere we need to work. So what is one thing that can transform people? One fundamental mistake we are making right now with the people, handling of the people, is We've given them this idea, if you fix the outside, everything is going to be okay. As already Paul said, you are living in the richest part of the world, but you are not the happiest lot on the planet. Okay? That means it's not worked. You fix the outside, but the inside doesn't work like that. So bringing this as a culture, see, today you have infrastructure for all kinds of things. You have industry, you have hospitals, you have this, you have that. There are more toilets than there are people. All these things are there, But there is no infrastructure to transform the inner nature of the human being at all. Hardly anything, it's almost zero. 150 years ago, almost 90% of the people who lived in this country were illiterate. Today, literacy is almost 100%. How does this happen? Because the schoolrooms were built, isn't it? You build the necessary infrastructure, so the rest happens. For the inner transformation of the human being, there is no investment at all. Private, little this and that, there is no large-scale development of infrastructure. As a part of this, we built the largest meditation hall in the Western Hemisphere in Tennessee right now, because this infrastructure needs to come up in big time, where people are focused towards their inner transformation. Otherwise, as there were illiterates 150 years ago, right now there's an illiteracy about how to handle myself. When you yourself are an issue, believe me, everything in the world will be an issue.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you both. So much to think about. Paul, at the beginning, you talked about socially responsible businesses not being something new, but going back hundreds of years. And when I think about companies like Quaker Oats and A&P and the others that you mentioned, I'm back to Tom Robbins' question of how do you make love stay? What enables companies to stay in that founding spirit over long periods of time when the ones you mentioned none of us would think of as particularly socially responsible? How is it kept and how is it lost?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure they can because Ari DeGus at Shell did a study on businesses, corporations that were over 400 or 500 years old. And the question is why? You know, how did they get so old? And what he discovered was that if you had a being goal instead of a doing goal, then you could adapt and change because it was about who you were, what the company was in the world as opposed to a rigid sense of what it does. But very few companies have survived that values orientation in terms of over decades or even centuries. And like I gave Heinz and Quaker Oats as examples because we don't really think of them. Maybe Heinz a little bit more because we know Andre Heinz and he's such a cool guy. But not really. You know, the company itself and Quaker Oats is gone. You know, and so I think that. I think we have to understand that businesses, just like anything else, they grow and live and die. And it's okay. You know, that they have a life, you know, that is over. I do want to say that, you know, what I love is how social conscious businesses are morphing and changing and what they think about. Outside, you'll see some drinks called Rebel, which means roots, extracts, berries, bark, and leaves. And it was started by David Batstone. Not for sale, which is really a business that's dedicated to sourcing and its ingredients from places where people were enslaved, and there's a lot of slaves right now in the world, and then selling them in a tonic that is actually good for you and has cat's claw and schisandra and ginseng and so forth in it, you know. And the profits go to NFS, or at least some of the profits do, a lot of them. And I want to say, and this is just a shameless plug, you know, that the person who created it and the CEO is my son. So, but it's shameless in the sense that, you know, he did so much better than I did when I started my first business. That's what I'm saying. And so there is this, I feel like there's this the literacy about how to go about doing social responsible businesses is just exploding. But how you make them last over time, I don't know if there is a way to do that, except when you do see a business that has a really strong culture, like an IBM, it means there was one charismatic, in the best sense of the word, CEO, who doesn't necessarily be the founder, but usually the founder, who set a kind of mind, you know, created a state of in that company that just persists way past his or her death and into the future.
Thank you. Yeah.
Good evening. Sadhguru, welcome to San Francisco. Thank you for sharing so much wisdom with us this evening. My question really goes to the question of motive. A lot of discussion between the two of you about consciousness and so on. And I'd like to set up a purposely difficult choice between a company, say, started by people with bad motives, mean people, self-aggrandizing, selfish, just not nice people, that achieve a wonderful outcome, some product that say they solve cancer, and another business started by people with wonderful intentions, environmentally responsible, holistic, a little commune, it's wonderful, and they achieve no success at all. Which is a better outcome for the world?
Now, when you do a certain activity, economic or otherwise, the most important thing, the most important aspect of any activity is to do it the way it works. If you do something that doesn't work, that's nonsensical activity, romantic maybe, but nonsensical, because you're wasting the resource on the planet and your own life in the process. So romanticism is fine, but when it comes to action, it has to work. Otherwise, what's the point? It's better not to work. If you want to do things which are wonderful, but does not really produce results for somebody else, come to me, I'll tell you, just close your eyes and sit joyfully. I'll see that you're fed, you just simply happily sit in one place. That's great, you're doing a wonderful job, at least you're not a problem, you know. So, intentions are fine, but any activity, if you do it, it must produce results, otherwise there's no meaning to that activity.
Thank you.
I had another question, but that comment has me. And what if doing focused on results ends up being exploitative, ends up being oppressive, ends up being not in the... I mean, I'll think about the women who were working in Bangalore, all right?
Bangladesh.
So this notion of that is the assumption of gaining results efficiently, but the process... So that, I'm not asking a question. So what do we? So what's our response to when the framing of results ends up in damaging and oppressing people?
I would say the values that you have evolved with a certain level of economic well-being, please do not impose that on the rest of the world. Do you understand? Somewhere a child is working, somewhere a woman is sitting up in the night. Do not judge this. Either the choice is she sits up in the nights and works and sleeps in the morning and has her lunch and dinner, or she goes hungry. That's the choice she has. I prefer that she works in the night. I prefer a child, an 8-year-old child works rather than being on the street and malnourished and dying at 15, 20 years of age. I prefer he works. Unless you can really make the world in such a way that every child can go to school, everything can happen to everybody, till they reach such an economic status as a society, imposing your levels of values upon them is completely unfair and it's a misunderstood concept. I prefer the child eats and goes, works, all right. It's exploitative, I know that, I'm completely against it within myself, but right now I'm okay with this because at least he gets to eat.
My question is for Sadhguru.
Why is everybody shooting at me?
An easy one. So this is regarding the point that you made earlier about investments for conscious business should come more from government who have a longer term vision than from venture capital who has a shorter term vision. As an entrepreneur, who's interested in doing a socially aware, conscious business, where do I start because the government is not there yet and the venture capitalists don't have the long-term vision to fund an idea or organization that's going to take a longer period of time to produce results?
Paul used some of the term, I forget, but I would use the term, it's pressure money. The money is under pressure. This money you cannot invest on aspects which need a long gestation. Right now, almost every socially conscious or environmentally conscious business is dependent upon technological breakthroughs. Technological breakthroughs are always on indefinite gestation, okay? There is no such thing as tomorrow morning we'll have a new technology ready. There's no such thing. It may happen tomorrow morning, it may happen 10 years later, nobody is certain about that. That will not come that way. Just because a few things have happened that way, it doesn't mean everything will happen that way. Technology doesn't come at will. It takes so much to happen around, you know. Nobody knows when it'll come. So this pressure money, which is on pressure, that it has to produce something on a daily basis, that money cannot serve that purpose. That's what I meant when I said the government has to chip in for these kind of things. Now that you are an entrepreneur, you want to do something ecologically sensitive and this, there are many opportunities to do, unless you're thinking of a breakthrough kind of stuff. If you're thinking of a breakthrough kind of thing, either you can join up Paul's company at a lower salary, or you can join up Isha Foundation free, it's on a voluntary basis. You can choose.
Thanks, I appreciate that. You'll be getting a lot of applications.
Paul, did you want to add to that?
It's difficult. I mean, it's exactly, I think, why we have this whole meeting tonight. I mean, this conversation is that it's difficult to do the right thing in the world right now. Not difficult to feel that you want to do the right thing, but to actually implement it in right now. And especially when it falls in the cracks between, you know, something that's small and you don't really need much capital and something that needs a lot of capital paid in, and the sources of those capital tend to be money under pressure. It's not the people are bad, the VCs and nothing like that. It's just that they're under pressure and they're under from somebody else's under pressure, and the pressure goes to the company, and then you start to make decisions in a way that you perhaps wouldn't. And so I don't think there's any answer for that, you know, and we don't have a good record in this country of governments actually making those decisions, investments. We actually have a pretty good record, though, in this country, and as other countries do, in the government investing in research and development. And I think that's where the government should go. It's more money to education, more money to universities, more money to institutes that are doing legitimate research, and then they can figure out how to commercialize it and who to license it to. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I wish we weren't controlled by, you know, people who think government is bad in this country, or, you know, the Congress wasn't controlled that way. So we could start to invest in the future. And right now, basically, as I've said many times, you know, we're basically, you know, selling the future in the present and calling it GDP. And, you know, we're destroying our children's future and calling it, you know, economic growth. And we could just as easily have an economic system which investments go to healing the future, to creating, you know, natural capital, to restoring living systems, to restoring our forests and our river and our coral reefs and our oceans and our atmosphere and our children's education and so much more. And we can make money doing that way too. We can make money either way, and we're so stuck on this idea that somehow we've got to sell the future and the present, otherwise we won't get rich fast enough. And I somehow that has to really change, and I think it's only going to change by example.
The small enterprise can run on pressure money. But the larger corporations and the government cannot run on pressure money. But right now, the government is running on pressure money, which is very unhealthy.
Next question.
Firstly, thank you, both of you. It was a really great discussion. I saw the topic, socially conscious business, and I was pretty much like how Sadhguruji talked about it. Every business is supposed to be socially conscious. So that's what I thought when I looked at the title. It was really useful, I should say, from my perspective, to see what's next in the socially conscious idea. So the question I have is pretty much for both of you. When I saw Paul talk about the objectification of a consumer, like when I, as a consumer, interact with a company, and then when I feel objectified, that's something that I don't want, right? So when we see a business should be socially conscious, there are some things that we have to put in as a vision for the company that comes from a consumer's perspective, right? Like what other things do you think would the consumer want that would make a business socially conscious?
I've always felt that I've only done businesses where I want to be the consumer, so I don't think about him or her as somebody other, and I've been happy to create businesses where I just thought there'd be a few customers, and in fact there were just a few, and my great my great-great-grandfather started his first company just right here at New Montgomery and Market Street and in 1849. And he specialized in books on in German and French on Catholicism and in 1849. And he went out of business and started a long history in my family and went down, became a farmer in Silicon Valley, and I wish he kept the land. And so I think that to me is you want to be the customer, and then you're never far away. You're never studying the customer. It doesn't mean you don't listen and get feedback and you know work with your customers. But I feel like the way to grow is to start small, and in that smallness you can make so many mistakes. And that's the problem with you know rapid money is that mistakes become too big. And when you're small, you actually want to make mistakes because then you're in a rapid iteration, rapid learning mode. And what we need in this time of enormous transition and change is failure. We need rapid failure. We need lots of failure. And we're in a society that basically marginalizes failure and lionizes success. Fine to lionize success and wealth, but what we actually need to do is be experimenting, trying this and trying this and trying this, because we really have to make huge changes in the next 20, 30 years in order for us to have some semblance of a civilization at that time. And I just think we need a way of looking at money and looking at a relationship where we actually, as they say, exalt and praise failure right from first grade on. And we need to create a culture where trying things and experimenting and learning is exalted, and I hope that's the change that we can bring forth. And I don't know how we can do that between government and big money. I think we do it with each other. I think foundations, which are so important, you know, in terms of contributing to you know NGOs and civil society and so forth, they too have to get rid of this fear that runs their boards. You know, like oh, we made a bad grant. I hope so. Make another one, and another one, and another one. Oh, we found something that really works. Now put some money into that. So that's how evolution works. And we now are devolving. We're not evolving in many respects because all the big money wants to follow basically big money. And that's fine, but we really need to follow the outside, the margins, those people who are basically creating things that will forevermore be on the margins in the sense that they're not going to aggregate into something that's huge and big. And so, we know how to do that. That's the thing. And I think the beautiful thing about what's happening right now is that the way I read things, and I try not to read the headlines too much, is that humanity knows what to do. We do know what to do. It's not like, oh, what to do, you know? We know what to do. Mm-hmm. And we're not listening to ourselves so well.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
It's time for our final question, and it's an informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the same last question, and that is, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
After you.
Okay. The world has never been the problem. It's the people who are the problem. So individual people, to transform individual people, something needs to be done. But 7.2 billion people is too much. So first thing is, there must be something to transform the leadership on the planet, particularly the leading nations. Why I'm saying the leading nations is, for example, right now United States has become a leader in so many ways. When I say leader, don't think of just economic and military powers. If you wear only blue-colored clothing, everybody in the world is wearing only blue pants all over the world. If you wear a torn pant, everybody is wearing torn pant. If you have a drink with carbon dioxide in it, everybody is drinking carbon dioxide, okay? So there is a leadership. So transforming this nation, I feel, is very key, and particularly the leadership. When I say transformation, it's not about fixing somebody. It is about, you must recognize this, whenever any one of you is very joyful, you are a wonderful human being. Whenever you are unhappy, miserable, frustrated, you could be a nasty human being. So bringing the leadership to a certain level of inner clarity and pleasantness within themselves is very, very important, because only when a human being is pleasant, he is not pressured to do things compulsively. Because once you're a leader, every thought, every emotion, every action that you perform is going to impact millions of people. So if your work is important, who you are needs to be worked at. If this one work we do, that the leadership on the planet at least becomes meditative, a little bit turning inward. If this happens, tremendous transformation will happen. When somebody asked me this question in the economic forum, one thing if you can do, Sadhguru, we can do for you, what is it? I said, get me 25 people for 5 days. I will transform the world within 3 to 5 years. Who are these 25? I named the 25 heads of state. Give them to me for 5 days, you will see the world is definitely transformed within 3 to 5 years because they can change the world. You can start bottom up, but that's a long process.
Did he take my time? Or? I actually never think about changing the world. I think about learning from the world, and everything I learn, I try to think, then how can I change my mind and myself? And then if I can do that, then I see the world differently and I learn from it differently, and then I try again to see how I can change myself. So I just think we've gotten in trouble when people have tried to change the world, and I think it can be just a gigantic narcissistic ego trip. And I think we're really in a good place when we keep going back to ourselves, the things that Sadhguru is saying, and try to understand the nature of our mind, the nature of our awareness, the nature of who we are, because I feel like humanity at its core is just so sweet and so beautiful, and it's covered up and obscured. And then when we can see that and feel that, then that is the bond of connectedness that is the world that holds hands and collaborates, and that's the world we need.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear.
Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Sadhguru and Paul Hawken.
Thank you
so much. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club and Forum is adjourned.